You're listening to the Australian Hunting and Beyond podcast with Matt, where we talk about hunting, shooting, fishing, camping, and everything else that the great outdoors has to offer. Let's get into it. All right. I have been talking about how bloody excited I am for the upcoming Roar in the Rut, and I was thinking what guests to get on, and I have come across a book which I absolutely loved called Secrets of the Red. So I reached out to the author, and he was kind enough to give up his time and join us tonight. So Paul Rattray, how are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. And thanks so much, Matt, for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to speak with you.
Mate, look, firstly, I just want to say I loved your book. It was a fantastic read. I haven't got to the second one yet, I will be honest. I've got both of them. I bought both of them, but I haven't got to the second. Bit hard sometimes. I've got like 18-month twins and a 3.5-year-old, so I don't have as much time as I'd like and with the podcast as well, but it is definitely on the cards. I thought coming into the Roar, who better? Because you've got a heap of experience, obviously wrote a book on it, and you have one of the most interesting backstories about how you got into hunting and how it all came about that I probably have heard. So, mate, can you give our audience just a bit of your backstory so they know what I'm talking about and why I think it's awesome?
Yeah, sure. I grew up on the island of Borneo amongst Dayak people, formerly known as the headhunters of Borneo. In most cases, they're no longer headhunters, apart from a few little flare-ups here and there. But they're also master hunters. And so one of the really, I think, formative parts of my life was growing up in a culture where older men invested in younger men. They took the time to tell stories, you know, take me out into the bush, show me how to do things, and then say, hey, you go and try it.
That's pretty cool. I don't think there's too many people out there that have got the opportunity to grow up like that. So that's like just a one of a kind thing. So that must have been just in itself. Did you know that at the time, that how like lucky you were to be sort of involved in this situation?
As a young kid, that they were the sort of people that I wanted to emulate. And so you don't really think too much, I guess, about the reasons why you want to emulate people, except that, you know, like I wanted to hunt like them. I wanted to have the bush lore that they had, that knowledge of, you know, where do you get water? What sort of behavior are you observing? Can you smell a certain smell? And, you know, I'd often not be able to smell the smell. And then they would show me, you know, just listen, smell, look. And then you'd be like, okay, I get it. I'm starting to get it. And so for me, it was really looking back later on when I was a young adult and thinking, you know, these life skills that have been taught to me as hunting skills are so valuable that if I could share them with others, then that would be for me perhaps the greatest legacy that I could leave for the next generation, not just, you know, my own children. I have six. And a couple of them are interested in hunting, but potentially others. You know, lots of guys would come to me and ask questions. I would take some of them out bush. I would mentor them, not just in hunting skills, but, you know, in life skills. And so for me, because those older guys were willing to spend so much time with me, you know, a dumb white kid, that for me, I really appreciated that. And so, for me, you know, it's very much about giving back, I think.
Look, That resonates with me very much. So being a teacher, I'm a high school PE teacher and I love what I do. And I think there's nothing better. And it's something I've spoken to my wife a lot and different people, because a lot of people I talk to about their jobs, it's not as rewarding as what I come across. They might earn a bit more money or they might do that, but there is nothing better for me. And I teach a lot of HSE classes, which is our year 12 here, getting them pretty much as they leave school. And there's nothing better seeing those kids work really hard with us for 2 years and get just amazing results. And it's just so pleasing that you've helped them along the way. And some of them have become like people that I chat regularly to. And, you know, they come back years after thing to come and just see us and tell us how their life is going and their journey and how much of an impact that I had on them teaching. And there's nothing greater than that. No money can give that. So I completely get why you wanted to do that with the book. And I'll tell you what, it's worked, because obviously it's impacted me enough to say, hey, I really want to have this conversation and get you on here, because it was something that I just went, this is cool. I want to hear more about this. So how did they hunt, for our listeners? So what kind of ways were you exposed to early on?
Yeah, they were hunter-gatherers. So similar to the Aboriginals or the First Nation people, Indigenous peoples of Australia, again, who I have, they're just amazing in their ability to be able to survive in an extremely harsh environment, like just amazing, even more amazing than the tribal people I grew up with, who grew up in lush tropical jungle. But it's the ability to just utilize everything within their environment. You know, they know what you can eat, what you can't eat, but also just their ability to be able to connect with nature. You know, I think to me that was one of the most powerful things. And so in growing up, they used a variety of techniques, you know, snares, dogs, spears, black powder muzzle loaders. Later on, we graduated to rifles and, of course, blowguns, poisoned dart blowguns, which is the traditional way that they used to hunt. So I've seen all of those in use, but perhaps the sort of the key hunting skills, which I talk a little bit about in the book, is just the awareness that they have to be able to sense things that most people miss completely.
That's one that always gets me, is that I love going bush. And I live in Sydney, in the city. So it is, when I get out there, it is such a different environment. And I find it does take me a little bit of time to really immerse myself into it and try and get into that headspace, I guess, if that makes sense. And I do think, I'm a Gamilaroi man, and that's my heritage on one side. And yeah, I'm with you. 65,000 years surviving in a really tough climate. Hats off, because I don't know how they did it. And thank God they weren't relying on me, because I'm not that great a hunter. So I probably would have been dead very early on. But it's absolutely amazing to see some of the traditional ways in action and just how finely tuned they are to their surroundings. I mean, to say it's impressive is probably a real big understatement.
Yeah, it is. I think we say it's impressive, perhaps because we don't appreciate the extent to which that local knowledge, that understanding, it's often intuitive. And I think partly that's why perhaps it's underappreciated, especially in the West, is because it's the sort of knowledge that is not easy to articulate, but they just know it. And so I've learned over the years, even here in Australia, you know, there's a lot of old bushies, and I even had an old mentor called Rex, who I mention in the book. They couldn't always tell me why. They just said, that's just the way it is, mate. But you learn to acclimatize yourself. And you know, the point that you make when we're not in that environment all the time, it's so important when we go into these environments, if there are people who are in these places where we hunt, you know, you call it local knowledge, local intelligence, they are much more intuitive. Whereas we, if we're in the city and in a, you know, like my job is similar to yours, I develop and train and work with people in projects around the world. You've got to get back into that headspace. The people who live on the land, who are doing this every day, you kind of have to prompt them because they are in that headspace all the time.
I've said that many a time, is that just because someone has a really good understanding of some content, whether it be hunting, doesn't matter what it is, it doesn't mean they're going to be a good teacher. And it's the ability of someone to be able to make sure that it is delivered to the student, just call them the student, doesn't matter what age they are. And they need to be understanding that, like whether you know, you're assessing them formatively or summatively at the end, but being able to make sure that what you are teaching is getting through to them and being able to deliver it to them in a way that they understand as well, because everyone's different. There's quite a few different learning styles and everybody learns differently. I, for one, I do things, I've got to be hands-on. I'm a kinesthetic learner. That's me. And I know that. And that's my, you know, that's my strength when it comes to learning. And if I'm not learning like that, and that's where I like to, you know, get out in the bush and make those mistakes, because that's how I learn. And the other way is talking. So that's where the podcast came from, to talk to people with much greater experience than I do, to try and get little tips and tricks to then apply when I get out there and still make those mistakes along the way and learn what they're talking about and why they were doing that for myself. And that's how I retain that information and get better. So it's a really interesting one, because I get what you're saying. I know some people that are fantastic hunters, but when you're talking to them to try and get the information out, they don't know how to get it across because they're just so used to doing it. They just do it. So it is really a skill, and it's something that I think is underappreciated in society, where some people have the knowledge and understanding and can't deliver it. And then the ones that really excel are the guys that know how to teach it, and it can explain to you why they're doing everything that they're doing clearly and make sure you're understanding it and not just sort of nodding your head going, yep, but it's going in one ear and out the other. So it is definitely a skill, and there's some really great people out there that do that.
There are. I mean, obviously there's a portion of hunters, good hunters, you know, who won't divulge their secrets. They won't tell you where they are hunting. They won't tell you some of their tricks, but you know, there's certainly many will. And I also find that landowners and farmers and people in those environments, sometimes you have to draw it out of them, because, again, it's just part of who they are. That's their life. Yeah. But I found, as I say in the book, and I really emphasize it, having local knowledge, being willing to spend the time with people who live in that area, is not only beneficial for access, but I find it is absolutely critical for me to get up-to-date local knowledge. If I've only got 2 or 3 days out in the bush, I don't want to spend 1 or 2 days figuring out what the heck is going on. I would much rather spend a few hours chatting with the landowner and finding out, you know, where have they seen deer? Where are they coming in? What do their movements tend to be? Where are the cattle in which paddock? Because mostly deer won't operate in the same paddocks where there are cattle if there are paddocks that are being spelled. These things are really critical information. You don't want to be going in to stalk deer and only find out that between you and them is a herd of cows that you weren't aware were there, and they spook everything in the whole neighborhood.
So you give a heap of different tips and tricks throughout the book, and you go into some really great detail, and we're not going to be able to cover a lot tonight. So I highly encourage people to get out there and check it out. Really simple to get it from you, and I'll put all the links in the show notes as well, but it comes in an audiobook as well. So you've covered all bases there, which is fantastic. look, we're not going to cover everything, but the Raw's coming up. And for the people there, what are some probably key things, if you could impart some, just a couple of key things for our listeners coming up to the Raw, what would they be to best position people to try and, you know, take a stag in that time?
Well, what I would say, first of all, is that it's important to understand that there is a rut, and the rut is the period of heightened, you know, sexual excitement amongst red deer, which is very similar to the season for fallow deer. So even now, the red deer are already starting to rub their antlers out. So they're in velvet and they're rubbing their antlers out. Some will have rubbed out, some will be halfway through, some will be just starting. So it's important to understand that there's a pre-rut period. And for example, anyone who knows cattle will know that what a bull is doing is he'll go around the paddock looking or smelling for cattle that are in oestrus, or they're ready to mate. That's essentially what the stags are doing. And so even, not quite yet, but in the next few weeks, they will start to be patrolling areas where they know there are females, sniffing the air, rubbing their antlers, trying to work out around about when they're going to be ready to mate. It's a very complex, you know, some factors that go in, weather, moon phases, or lunar cycles, but we can be pretty confident that within the next month or so, in most places, they're going to start roaring. And so it's important to recognize that the pre-rut is actually quite an important time for those who are able to get out bush, have a look around, because you'll find that the closer that you get to the rut, you'll then start to see stags. They'll start to position themselves. If it's hilly country, they'll start to position them around the tops of knobs where they can get a good vantage point. And if it's flatter country, they'll tend to get to the top of like a gully or a creek system. And so the whole idea is they're looking out to see if they can see where other stags are. And they will often rub their antlers on trees to expose the inner bark, which is a different color. And it will almost always be focusing outward where they know that other stags will be able to see that and think, oh, okay, there's a stag up there. And so if you glass around these areas very, very carefully and watchfully, you'll often find that there will be trees that are rubbed with their outer bark rubbed off. And that's a very strong indicator when they rub the outer bark of the tree off like that, that they're preparing for the roar. So that's the pre-rut and then the rutting period. So that when they're rutting doesn't mean they're roaring the whole time. They will have already positioned themselves. They'll often have even started to push the hinds or the females. They'll already start to herd them as well, even before they start roaring.
So I've never heard one roar, and that's the goal this this upcoming roar is to hear one. I've seen it on YouTube. It just looks so amazing, and I got hooked last year. I'm fairly new into my deer hunting career, and I got hooked with the fallow croaking last year and had a couple of real cool experiences, which I've talked about before. So I hear that, but I just think the roar is going to be so much better. So I'm really, really keen to get out there. And that's the big one for me, is trying to hear one roar. If I tell you one, that'd be amazing, but I'm not holding my hopes there because, you know, I've only got one deer, and I'm always pretty honest about that. And that's cool. But just hearing them, it's just such a great sound. So I'm dying to hear it.
It's
so
amazing.
Hopefully that will come off.
It's amazing. Like, it'll make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. It's just the sound goes through you, and they are so good at throwing their voice so that it sounds like it's coming from over here when it's really in another direction. And so it's just incredible, especially if you can hear a few going at it. You know, they'll often get up in the hills And then, yeah, there's a couple of places I hunt. You might hear half a dozen or more stags bellowing back and forth at each other across the valley. And it's
That's cool.
You just sit there and you get goosebumps.
Oh, what an experience. It's, just hearing about stuff like that just gets me so pumped up and excited to be able to hear that. And that's the goal for this year from the red side of it. So you touched on that there. Do they get up high and that's where they tend to be, to obviously look over their hinds to sort of keep a view of what's going on? And is that what they're doing? Yeah.
So if they possibly can, and in most cases, there's very little country with large numbers of wild, as in free, red deer that is not in hilly country. Very unusual. They will come down to cultivation at certain times of the year. Very unusual in the raw, but occasionally, if that's where in a dry season, when that's where all the hinds are on cultivation or green grass, but normally they'll be up high, because they want to get up as high as they can so that they can look down, see who their rivals are, and they call up the hinds. So what they do is the hinds, they will be down in the valleys as a rule because they eat feed that is more similar to cattle. Stags eat more woody plants and weeds. They tend to stay up in the hills more. And so unless it's an extremely dry period, they'll always stay up high and the hinds will tend to stay down low. And so what the stags do is they bellow, and that is what draws the hinds up, because they recognize, just like people recognize and women recognize a deeper voice, that's exactly how the hinds recognize which stag is more dominant by the depth of their bellow.
It's cool when you think about it, isn't it? Just the hot, just nature in general and how they go about what they do, and just that they exist. It's such a cool thing. It's hard to explain to people, and I do struggle with that. And it's one I think I do a relatively good job, but I still don't think I can ever really emphasize how much I love these animals for someone that goes, but you shoot them. And it's like, yeah, but they are amazing. You don't understand that I have so much respect for these things. And just because I shoot one is not because I hate them. It's not a malice or an anger thing. It's simply because I want to, you know, take part in conservation, that I want to use the meat. And that's the goal. That's why I'm chasing them and doing what I do. And it's hard for some people to understand that. And look, I get that, coming from the Western world, and you know, it's really easy to duck to the supermarket and grab that meat. So I get where they're coming from, but it's hard to describe. But everyone I talk to that's a hunter, well, most people that I talk to that are hunters, geez, they love them. And they spend a lot of time and money and effort to chase them and to do things. How long have you been chasing reds particularly? And why reds? Because obviously that's where you've honed in on. And why that?
They have a special place in my heart. I have hunted lots of other deer species, but I was blessed in coming back to Australia. I suffered a lot of culture shock, even though you'd look at me and think, why would he have culture shock? It's because I was different inside, even though I looked quite similar on the outside. But I came to eventually to the Sunshine Coast hinterland, and the hinterland is right next to the headwaters of the Mary Valley and not far from the Brisbane Valley. And so that is where most of the red deer are in Queensland, is in the southeast. They are spreading, but that's predominantly where they are. And so I just had just those few opportunities, again, where someone took me under their wing and said, hey, let me introduce you to someone. They'd heard that I was able to hunt. And so from there, that's just how it built up. And I had a couple of, like, my old mate Rex, who showed me, you know, how to hunt red deer, what, you know, some of the tricks of the trade. And so I just gradually got this fascination with them because I've always liked to document things. I've always been sort of a researcher at heart. I've done some degrees and really, you know, like research is something that I like doing. So taking notes, observing, you know, that's unusual. Why do they do that? And just recognizing that, like fallow deer, red deer have really defined, distinct seasons in which they operate. And so I thought, well, raw, okay, what's the rut? Well, the rut is when they're sexually active, and the roar is when they are telling you about it. Okay, well, when does that happen? Is that the same? So I have details from every roar that I've been to on four or five of the main hunting blocks that I hunt for the last 10 to 15 years. When did they start? When did they finish? What were the conditions? And so for me, that's just been part of my practice. And so because of that, I could answer questions when people asked me, you know, when are the deer moving through here? Well, they will be moving through here during the winter because the stags will be after weeds and it'll be up on these areas. And then when it's in the calving season, the hinds will be down in these valleys because they're close to farmhouses, because they're safer from dingoes than they are out exposed in the open. And so just those observations and always talking to the landowners. When did you first hear red deer? You know, when did they start roaring? I don't need to call them up and ask them now. The minute they start roaring, they're calling me or texting me and saying, I heard my first roar. And so that's really how I got into it, was that people would ask me things and I would say, okay, well, I've taken some notes and so this is what I've learned. Obviously, I had that background, which made me quite a good hunter anyway in terms of tracking, being able to see entry, exit points, all those sorts of things, and learning those behaviors and then just sharing them with others. And like you said, not everyone is happy to share their local knowledge and intelligence. I don't look at things like that. I'm like you. I'm happy to share everything that I know if I can, if you're willing to spend the time with me. And so I had a few people on the other side, farmers and hunters, who would sit down and talk with me and answer questions. And I could perhaps write things down, like you said. They knew stuff but didn't know necessarily how to put it down in an organized way. And perhaps because of my upbringing, where many of my adopted fathers were illiterate or were not well educated, I was often interpreting stuff to, because I spoke some of the local languages, to some of the other people who didn't speak those languages. And so that was something that I learned, and I've applied that to my deer hunting. And so, yeah, reds are just fascinating, especially the stags, with their massive antlers and their, you know, they only bellow in the roar. They're pretty quiet outside of that. Even that's just amazing, you know. They just don't roar at any other time of year. Well, there's a few exceptions, but it's just, to me, it was fascinating. And I couldn't find the information that I needed from, you know, I could find plenty of research because they're a relatively, you know, ancient species in terms of their interaction with humans, lots of research, a lot of technical information, especially from farmed animals. But I just wanted more of the practical aspect of, you know, how can I learn to hunt these things really well?
And I think that comes across in the book, and that's what I noticed. And it's something that I'm definitely going to be going over it again before we get into it. And it's probably a good time to say to our listeners, today is actually the 1st of February. So when we're talking about sort of time frames, just so you have a bit of a time stamp on the podcast, because I'll try and get this one out very quickly because, you know, of the time sensitive nature for the raw. But it's exciting to be able to put the puzzle pieces together. And that's one of the things I was, you know, I was taking from the book, is that you could see that you love the research side of it and the gathering of the information, and being able to connect those dots or fill the little puzzle pieces in to give you that understanding. And that is something that I've been trying to apply, of going, okay, well, when did I hear those croaks last year from the fallow? Because I know they only did it on my last day and a half of hunting. So that was that date. So this year I'm planning on going back roughly around the same time, earlier, because we were at the back end, and seeing if it's the same. I wish I would have had your book earlier, because I didn't think about what was the weather doing, what had the temperature done. I didn't do that. And obviously, I probably could go on the internet and actually find it. I haven't thought about that just yet. But that's one of the things that I really took away from the book, is being a bit more understanding of more of the things that are going on, not just what are the deer doing, because that is important, obviously, but it's also all these other things that might be influencing their behavior. And that's important to know too. And that's probably more important for somebody like myself, because I live in Sydney. So my hunting areas, I love the Snowy Mountains, but they're, you know, a good 3.5 hours away. So I need to know that stuff to try and pick the times to get down there, because I'm not down there. I do have a couple of mates down there. I think I'll be speaking to them to say, hey, when are you hearing stuff? And I think that's a great idea to have a bit more of an understanding, and that will be very helpful in that. So I'll be leaning on some of the locals down there that I'm mates with. Obviously, how do you approach the next couple of weeks? So it's getting close. They're rubbing out, as you said, they're in velvet or possibly, you know, starting to rub that off anyway. How do you approach the next couple of weeks? Is it you're looking where the hinds are, or you're more looking for those trees because, you know, there's some, hopefully a big fella in the area? How do you go about the next couple of weeks in the lead up?
Well, there's a few things. And I think the most important thing I would say is that if you're able to identify places where you know there are deer and you consistently go to those places, that's where you're going to be most successful. Not trying new places all the time. If there are no deer there, then of course there are no options. But we also have to be very careful about just saying, well, I went to that property and there were no deer. All right. There may not have been deer there, because stags will often live in a completely different valley, sometimes many, many kilometers away, and then they come only to roar in that particular valley with that particular group of hinds for maybe a week or two, and in some cases, especially the dominant stags, move on. They don't stay for the entire rut. So it's so important to know, are there simply no deer there whatsoever, or are there no deer there at this particular time of year? And they don't roar in exactly the same place every time. It will depend primarily on the amount of feed that's available. So in my case, even though I haven't been able to get out too much, I'm talking to the landowners almost every week. Where have you seen the deer? Where are the hinds? Because it's the females that they will tend to see. Well, the hinds are consistently in this part of their farm. I know from long periods and years of observation, okay, that's because of feed. Where have you seen the stags? Haven't seen any stags. Okay, that doesn't make me lose heart. It just means that they must be up high because they're just not seeing them lower down. So the weather patterns are really important, because here in southeast Queensland, we've had tons of rain just in recent times. So have you, I think.
No, my parents live up in Hervey Bay. Okay. So I just went up there for Christmas, and I was hoping to get some fishing in and the like. And oh my God, there wasn't a day that it did not rain, and the humidity was just horrid.
Oh, I know. And
I've never seen it like that. It was insane. Yeah. Like it was such
unusual this year, the humidity. But what it does is your grass growth is just going to be phenomenal. And so that means that the good quality grass will be way up high in the hills. There is no need for those stags to come down. And so what that tells me, and what I've been hearing from all of my hunting mates, they're saying the stags are up high. What that tells me is when they start roaring, the hinds will go up high as well. So I'm not even considering too much low flats. They're going to be up high. And so that adds a layer of complexity, because it means I'm going to have to climb up to the tops of the hills in grass that's way overhead high to try and get back down, because it's nearly impossible to climb up in real thick grass like that and be able to get a decent crack at anything. So these are just all the factors that I need to consider, especially if it's really wet right up to the roar. I need to recognize they're not going to roar as much as when it's a cold, crisp weather. They'll also not roar if it's super, super hot. So it doesn't mean they're not going to roar, but it means that they're not going to roar as consistently, say, throughout the day. They're going to stop pretty early in the morning, and they're only going to start later in the afternoon. So I have to position myself, make my plans, and that might include even your holidays. So there's guys that I mentor as far away as Patagonia. If you looked at some of my posts the other day, one of my buddies writing to me and saying, what do you think? Do you think they might go early this year with all the rain? I don't know. But what I said to him is, look at your notes, look at your records. He's been going back to the same area over a number of years. Check, when did they roar last year? Is there any trend? I've noticed if there is any trend, it's that they are roaring just fractionally earlier than they were before in some places, but in other places, it's just fractionally later than it has been. I don't know exactly why in all cases, but I follow the data. I follow what people tell me. And then I factor that into taking my leave. And it's also when, if I'm taking, say, a week off and I've got two or three places to go, I want to find out when the peak of the roar is at each of those places and try to time that. So the peak of the roar, it's like a bell curve. If they start roaring on this date, then usually about 10 days in, that will be the peak, and then it'll start to taper off over the next week or so. And so I can then work that out and say, okay, for the first 2 days, that's the peak here. Then I'll go to the next block, and that's going to be when they tend to peak there. They don't tend to peak exactly at the same time. And maybe I'll come back then to another one because they tend to be a little bit later. And so I plan it all out. It's like a military operation, because that's the best way to get a chance to have a listen to them roaring, as well as if you want to see the best heads. That's the peak, is when the most dominant stags will show themselves.
It's just so cool, isn't it? I'm a bit of a data nerd, always have been. And, you know, I cop it a lot as a PE teacher, because, you know, we're supposed to be just like kicking balls around an oval. But I'm very big on like literacy and the writing and the data of everything. I love unpacking that and looking at it and critically thinking about all these different things. So when you're talking this language and saying you need to do this, it's just, I'm sitting here going, all right, this year I'm not going to do the same mistake as last year for the fallow. I'm going to apply exactly what you're saying. I'm going to document and work out when they're going off, what's going on, what are the temperatures during the day, what are the temperatures at night, what's the highs, the lows, is it rainy, is it sunny? Because I think that's one of the things, as I said, I didn't do it last year and I'm kicking myself now because I didn't read the book beforehand. I did it afterwards and I'm sitting here going, I wish it was a missed opportunity. But hey, that's all about growth and learning.
And wind direction.
100%. You know, yes.
If you've read my book, I harp on probably ad nauseum to some people's perspective, but it's so important to understand aspects of wind direction. So again, when I'm planning my hunt, if I know that there's going to be a southerly that's blowing up into the hills where I know there's stags roaring, I don't even bother going. There's no point. if that wind is blowing from me up to the hill and I can't get around behind them, all I'm going to do is spook them. All they have to do is smell me, and then they'll move out of that area up into even more inaccessible areas. So I pay close attention to wind direction. And it's also recognizing that prevailing winds are not the same as localized winds. You can have a prevailing, you know, northeaster, but because, you know, like a whirlpool in a river, that wind can actually be going back the opposite way. Once it hits a hillside, it can then be pushing its way down to the southeast. And so I factor all those things in. Even when I'm planning the hunt, I'll often ring up and say, it says it's a southeasterly, but is that what you're seeing there on the farm? And you know, if it's a strong wind, they'll say, yep, that's right. And then, but if it's not, sometimes I say, no, not really. No, it's more of an easterly. Oh, that's bad in some of the blocks I hunt, because it means I can't get access into some of those hills because they're further to the west of me. And so it's factoring all of those things in, and wind direction is absolutely critical, because the stags, the big stags, will always surround themselves with hinds, and they might be careless, but the hinds, the females, are not. They are constantly hyper aware. They're looking for other stags because they are familiar with that stag, so they're looking for the rivals. They'll bark if they hear a rival, and they're looking for hunters. And so it's absolutely critical that we understand wind direction, and we understand how to use wind direction, and perhaps most importantly, not to push. Wait for the wind to die down. You learn things that in the mornings, the cold is going to tend to push itself back up into the hills. And so that's not a great time if you're going to climb straight up. It's just going to push your scent. But you realize in the afternoon that cold air will start to come down. So oftentimes it's better to wait until the afternoon. These things, this sort of patience is off, you know, it's that 1%, those 1% things, you know, as a data nerd, you understand that it's those little 1% things that you encourage the kids in their physical education and development. It's not the big things, it's those little things that they incrementally come together. It's just being aware, not pushing into country. You know, there's one block we used to hunt in the Mary Valley. We got hundreds of deer there, and there were lots of other hunters would come in. They would get so frustrated because some of them would be there for days. Some would be even there for weeks. And we would come in for 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon or 2 or 3 hours in the morning, shoot 2 or 3 deer and be gone again. Why? Because we knew where the deer were coming in from. And when we knew that, we knew not to disturb their tracks. We knew not to get where the wind would blow back across that gully, because we knew that would be where the deer are camped. Well, that's where they'll be coming down. They'll be waiting up on the hill. All they have to do is have a sniff. And if they can smell that there are people there, or they can hear that there are vehicles driving around that they don't recognize, they recognize, they know the difference between the Cocky's old Land Cruiser that goes up and down the road every couple of times a day to something else that they've never heard before. They know the difference between, there's a vehicle parked down in that creek. We've never seen that vehicle parked in there before, or we know what that means. And so anything out of the ordinary are the sorts of things that will get these animals on edge. And so the whole idea is it's understanding these sorts of behaviors so that we maximize the potential of being able to get in and make a good shot, a clean shot, and minimize, you know, any risk of them getting away wounded.
Look, that is one of the things I will say I really appreciate about your book. You talk about being an ethical hunter and talk about that you want to make sure that you are doing everything as humanely as possible. And that is a big thing I preach about on the podcast. Probably people get sick of hearing me talk about that, but I'm very much about that. And I have never taken a shot if I'm not comfortable. The last rut, I had a spiker in my sights, but at about 100, and I hadn't been doing much freestanding shooting, and I wasn't comfortable to do it. I didn't have the tripod. Someone else had the tripod, so I didn't feel comfortable, so I didn't take the shot, and he, you know, just slowly trotted away. At that stage, I hadn't even got my first deer yet, but I'm still very big on that and saying to people, do what you're comfortable doing. Don't do something that's going to injure or maim or harm. So know your limits and only push it to what you're comfortable to do, because it is another living creature and you've got to have respect for that animal. So I really appreciated in your book when you were talking about those things consistently and being an ethical, law-abiding hunter, because it is something I think is the – we need that from hunters. We need that so that our lifestyle, our culture, our sport, whatever you want to call it, is going to be sustained and have a longevity to it for future generations. So thank you for that in that book. When is your favorite time to hunt them? Is it more in the morning, in the afternoon? Do you have a particular preference?
It depends more on the country. I mean, just personally, I prefer afternoon because you don't get wet and soggy, you know.
From June.
But it's never stopped me if that's it. It will all depend to some extent on weather. But it also depends on positioning. So, for example, what I've often found is that stags in particular, they do change their behavior a bit during the roar especially, but during the rut, you know, they become a little bit more careless and a bit more silly. But as a rule, they don't like to expose themselves to direct sunlight. And so that, again, is a really important hunting skill that you develop over time. You only really develop that if you know your country. So if you know that the sun is going to be coming up and it's going to be hitting this particular slope first, then you know that in most cases, once the sun comes up, the deer are going to be on the shaded slope. And so if in the morning it's going to be a shaded slope on one side, you know that in the afternoon, it's going to be a shaded slope on the other side of the valley. And so that then allows you to work out, well, okay, in the morning, I need to go here. I need to factor the sunlight in with the wind and the weather as well. And so that's perhaps one of the key things is working out, you know, morning or afternoon. As a rule, especially outside of the rut, stags are far more active in the afternoon, and the hinds or females seem to be much more active in the morning. They will operate both, but as a rule, unless it's during the rut, they don't tend to congregate together. So if there's hinds feeding here, stags will tend to feed somewhere else, even if it's in the same vicinity. It's only in the roar when they'll come together. But the stags don't eat so much in the roar. They will come down to water holes, and as a rule, they'll come down in the afternoon when it's hot. During the rut, they'll come down to wallow, and they'll also come down because they know there's females there. They'll often follow females down. Females tend to drink in the morning, not always, but stags tend to come down in the afternoons or very early in the mornings. They don't tend to expose themselves to sunlight as much as the females.
Okay. Like there's so much information, and I really appreciate you obviously sharing that with our guests. And it's hopefully giving people a bit of an insight into how good the book is. And you know, if you do want to learn about red deer, definitely jump on it. When you're talking wallows, is there certain country and areas that you should be sort of looking to find them? I mean, I'll put my hand up. I've found a handful, but not, I'm not great at finding them. Is there particular areas you would be saying, okay, they're a bit lower, a bit higher, obviously generally on flat ground, but how would you give advice to someone that's a bit newer in looking for them?
Yeah, well, what I'd say is that it depends again on your country. In flat country, they'll normally wallow in creek beds or beside dams. But again, almost, I would say 90% of reds in Australia, like in most parts of the world, they're in hilly country. And so surprisingly enough, unless it's super, super dry, there are spots. And again, this is, you got to get to know your country. There are spots that are, and Indigenous Aboriginal people know this. They know that there are places way up high in hills, but they, of course, understand much better than I do anyway. They understand all the contours. They understand where water is. But I have found permanent water in places that you would just, you would not credit that there was water there. And so if you know some of these places, you are almost guaranteed to be able to bump into, at the very least, you don't want to do that, but you know they're going to be coming in and having a drink. They don't tend to wallow in the places where they drink unless it's a relatively large body of water. And then it's also important to understand that, especially during the rut, basically anywhere where there's a little bit of water up in the hill, so, you know, there's a little bit of rain, they'll be in there because they want to urinate in there. They want to get in there and get all their scent stinking things. They are. You can smell them a mile away during the rut. And you can often smell, like I said before, getting a sense of smell, knowing the difference. That's a stag. It's not a hind. And working those things out, you'll often find just wherever you get these little indentations in the ground, these little dips at the sort of halfway to three quarters of the way up a hill, you'll often find there's a little wallow there, even there's just been a tiny bit of rain. Then the other thing to keep in mind is stags will also have what they call scrapes. And so they will have a territory that they tend to patrol, at least for a week or 10 days. Sometimes they'll move on, but they'll have an area that they patrol. They'll urinate in some of these areas, and they develop these scrapes. They scrape their antlers along the ground. They paw the ground with their hooves, and then they'll lie down in that and roll in that. And they urinate and they roll in it, and they get their scent all around, and then they go and put their scent on all of the trees in their territory. And they'll often rub their antlers at the same time as they're going through, breaking off little branches and trees. And so it's being aware, watching, finding out, you know, like I said earlier, where are you seeing rubbing that's exposed, that's there to say, hey, look at me. That's a very good indicator that's part of their territory. And they might walk around that at least once a day or at least once during the night.
Do you find trail cameras help out by putting them on sort of those locations to really get an understanding of movement?
Yeah, I don't use them, but yeah, absolutely. They are really good if you're working out routines. The thing to keep in mind with big stags in particular, dominant stags, they didn't get big by being stupid. And I found the same, very similar with large wild boar as well. They won't come in to water or to wallow at the same time every day. They will come in at odd times. And also, even during the peak, maybe not the peak, but most of the roar, maybe the peak, they just can make some stupid mistakes. But normally, they will let the hinds go in first, and the big ones will hang back and watch just to make sure that there's nothing around that's a potential risk to them, and then they'll come down. They'll seldom be the ones to lead. They almost always allow the hinds to go first, and then they'll come down. And that's why often guys, when they're first starting out, they hear the roaring, they see the hinds, and they think, okay, all I've got to do is cut across here. And they expose themselves because the big stag hasn't come down yet. You got to wait. And sometimes you have to wait a fair while because he's not just going to follow them straight down. You'll often find there might be a couple of other stags, less dominant ones. They'll quickly take the opportunity, run down. But the big guy, he's just hung back. He's not threatened. He'll get his girls. They'll come back up. All he's got to do is roar once or twice and they'll come back up. But what he does is he's watching. He's always watching. And anything out of the ordinary, those hinds will bark. And then that's it. He's gone.
It's almost like he's the puppet master and he's just the little pawns sending them out and, okay, it's safe, it's good for me here and come here and just moving them around like he wants them, which is, it's such a cool thing when you think about that as well. All right. Have you got a really cool story for us to wrap up the podcast? Because I know people love hearing stories and you know, probably more for me, but yeah. Have you got one that just sticks out in your mind, something to really get people excited for the roar?
Oh, if it's for the roar, yes, I do. If you ask me, though, what makes me most, gives me, I guess, the most encouragement and pride in the right sense of the word, it would be a few of the people that I've mentored who've gone out. They may not, my favorite story is actually he didn't get a stag. He just got a hind. But he came from a German background family, I think of over 10 generations of hunter, seven, I think it was. They lost all their family properties. He lost his connection to hunting and he wanted to get it back. And he was able to get a hind. We spent hours together, him asking me all these questions. Detailed questions, as the Germanic people tend to do. And he wrote to me and just said, thank you, because I've reconnected with my past. That's cool. And to me, that was really powerful. But one of the most exciting roars that I can remember is when I was able to roar in one of the biggest stags I ever got by learning to match my roars with his. So it's important just to understand as a little skill. I know a lot of guys use recordings of roars. I don't. I use a pipe. But it's important to remember that if you're using an overly dominant roar, which most of the recorded roars are, and it's not as dominant, that stag is not going to come in because they're not going to go up against a voice that's deeper than theirs. So we have to moderate. And so this was so exciting. I could hear this stag roaring. And so I had a go and I realized it's just not quite right. And so I tried again and then I realized, yep, I've got the tone right because he's starting to roar back at me aggressively. But he was cautious. And so what he did was, like a lot of stags do, instead of coming straight down at me like some of the immature ones, sometimes they'll chase you, literally, come crashing down the hill when you start to roar. He started to circle around because what he was doing is he was wanting to find the wind so that he could get around and actually smell. And so what I did was then I followed him around so that he couldn't get around behind me. And at one point where he was coming around, I thought, this is it, because if he gets around any further, he's going to smell me for sure. And so I kept those aggressive roars, just like he was doing back at me, and he turned for just a fraction of a second. And so it wasn't the perfect angle, but I knew that I was going to have to shoot straight through the neck rather than through the back of the shoulder. And so the minute he turned, I was able to bring the rifle up and bang and put him straight down. And so for me, that was just one of the most exciting roars that I've had, is because it all came together and I was able to use some of those skills that I the kids often laugh at me, practice roaring. And they say, "Oh, Dad, that sounds so cool. Yeah, you sound exactly like a stag." And so I was able to do that and able to get a really nice set of antlers, which is really a secondary thing. It was the fact that I was able to match it with that magnificent animal and, you know, ultimately be able to take him.
All right. What a way to end the podcast and giving a bit of detail about just some of the things that are in the book. Obviously, we can't cover all that in the podcast, but I really encourage people, if you want to find out more and read the book, there is some gold in there. The calling, as you were just talking about, that back and forth with stags, you talk a lot about that in there, and there's so many tips and tricks and the intricacies of it. So, mate, I really appreciate the fact that you did write the book, because I am a big fan of it. I'm definitely going to listen to it again. I'll listen to the audio podcast, and I'll probably read it as well, to be honest, especially coming up into this raw. Can you let people know, A, where they can find it, and how much they are? And I'll also chuck it up on the podcast show notes as well, so people know.
Yeah, sure. Well, look, thanks again, Matt, for giving me the time to share some of what I've learned and some of what is my passion, or my wife calls it obsession. Yeah, so what I would encourage people to do is the easiest way to get the book is to go to Secrets of the Reds. You can find that easily on Facebook. The reason I say that, there are a few other ways, but that's the easiest way. You can also join the conversation. Just like you reached out to me, I'm more than happy to spend time with people, more than happy to share some of the things I've learned, on one condition, that you're willing to share that with other people as well. And so one good thing about the page is that it's there so that we can share. I've got other mates who are on that page who are landowners. Some of them are professional hunters and guides. They're more than willing to share their information and their knowledge and give some tips and talk through a few things. So that's the best place to get the book. It's a digital book, which means that you download it. It's in EPUB, which means that you can read it on a mobile device or an iPad. It's also in PDF, which means that you can read it on a laptop or print it out. So that's $25 for all of those versions. And then, as you said, there's an audio book. That's my voice. I voiced it myself. And so you can also get that. And normally I sell that for $20. But if you want to get the package, I can do the whole package for $35, but that's only if you get both.
And then you also have the other book. Is it Venison Diplomacy? Sorry, I haven't.
Yeah, so I do. Yes, I have a couple of other books there as well. So it's I love alliteration for those who have read some of my material. It's called Virtues of Venison.
That's the one. I couldn't think of it off at the top of my head. I was sitting there going, "What is it again?"
It's more specifically for people who really want to utilize the meat, and so there are techniques for cooking game meat, not just venison. There are a lot of techniques for cooking game meat that make game meat much more palatable than, I hear a lot of feedback from people saying, game meat, I'd love to try it, but, it's got such a strong smell or such a strong taste. Well, of course it does. It's called game, and that's where we get the word gamey from. But actually there are techniques, and so I provide some of those techniques there. I share some of the best types of recipes, also the way to butcher. I do touch on it in the book, but this is more specialized, more specific, and with some photos as well to show you how things are done. So you can also get that through there as well.
I love it. Pay it forward. It's a big thing that I try and do throughout my life too. So I think that's such a great idea. And anytime you can help somebody else get better and grow as a person, it's always a win. Paul, I really appreciate your time coming on the podcast. Thank you very much. And mate, absolutely love the book. And hopefully we'll be able to do this again soon. Best of luck with the upcoming Raw. I can't wait to see how you go.
Oh, and you too. Yeah, thank you.
Don't think I'll be as successful as you, but that's all good. Hey, got to try it. So, all right, listeners, thanks very much for listening. Bye for now.
If you have a topic, guest, question, or any gear that you want to hear about on the podcast, shoot us an email, australianhuntingandbeyond@gmail.com. Alternatively, find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. All the links are in the show notes. If you haven't already, make sure you give us a review and subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you're listening on. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.